Welcome to Native America Calling. From Studio 49 in Albuquerque, I'm Monica Brain. When the National Park Service did a survey looking at race and ethnicity, they found that the vast majority of park visitors are white. About 20% are people of color. Only 1% are Native American. That's far below their representation in the population. Some outdoor enthusiasts are trying to get more Native Americans to enjoy the outdoors. Getting out in nature, we'll discuss that right after the news. Stay with us.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Arctic coastal villages in Alaska are being eaten by rising sea levels and waves from fall storms, which were once held back by sea ice. Many people have no choice but to relocate, a lengthy and costly process. Reporter Christine Trudeau of KYUK in Bethel went to one village, which is relocating right now in western Alaska.
Go!
Here's how the village of Maktagavik begins. A newly extended boat harbor, one avenue with 5 to 6 homes, a steam house, and foundational pilings for 4 more homes. This will be the new home for the people of Nutok in southwestern Alaska. People gathered at the site on the bluffs above to cut the ribbon, and Alberta Charles is thrilled to be here.
It's a safe land. It's high. It's beautiful.
Still under construction is the Maktagavik Evacuation Center, which could shelter 250 people if they can find the funding to finish it. Future federal funding is the biggest uncertainty threatening continued progress at Maktagavik. Lynn Palaka, the Bureau of Indian Affairs Acting Regional Director, says Nutok is only one of many villages at risk from climate change. The BIA, he says, is able to help fund transportation and roads, but does not have as much money available for housing. Nutok resident Albertina Charles is ready to be among the first to move to Maktagavik.
My daughter is scared for my grandchild. She wanted me to take her with me so she can be safe here. Because last year the water rises more than usual.
With gray skies coming in, Albertina Charles remembers those fall storms, the high water levels that come with the rains, and the devastation that has come to a sinking land. On the bluff, for National Native News, I'm Christine Trudeau.
There are more than 300 tribal courts across the United States. A new PBS documentary shows how two tribal judges in California are working to restore communities and affirm tribal sovereignty. Hannah Colton reports.
The film follows two trailblazing tribal judges. One of them, Claudette White, is the first tribal member to serve as chief judge on the Kachan Tribal Court in Southern California. White says her orders often incorporate traditional customs and emphasize peacemaking over punishment. But her work over the past decade has also been about asserting tribal sovereignty in an area where the county and state sometimes wrestle for jurisdiction.
I am really proud of the collaboration that we've been able to establish with some of the our state counterparts in the courts and then with the different service providers. And so for the first time in a long time, we're seeing the neighboring jurisdictions actually communicating with us directly, willing to attend joint trainings and to learn about what it is that's happening on the reservation and in our court.
Anne Makepeace is the producer and director of Tribal Justice. She hopes viewers, and especially young lawyers, will gain a new awareness of what restorative justice can look like.
There's a real understanding now that the criminal justice system in this country is not working. So I think there's an openness to a restorative justice model, which the tribal courts and tribal justice show, you know, how it can work.
Tribal Justice will premiere on the PBS documentary series POV on Monday night. For National Native News, I'm Hannah Colton.
Many people on the Navajo Nation are following traditional practices as the solar eclipse takes place by staying inside and fasting. Navajo Nation government offices are closed, as well as some schools. Dene College is hosting a teaching event with traditional guidance and prayer from medicine people. The solar eclipse is a reflective and reverent time for many tribes across the country. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting with support from the Public Radio Satellite Service.
Support by BNSF Railway, proud partners of the American Indian Science and Education Society's National Conference, September 21st to 23rd, helping prepare the next generation of STEM leaders. More at bnsf.com/tribalrelations.
Yate, support by the Albuquerque Hispano Chamber of Commerce Convention and Tourism Department, providing complete convention and visitor planning services to Native American conventions. Information on convention and tourism services at siabq.org.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
This is Native America Calling. I'm Monica Brain, sitting in for Tara Gatewood. People of color are missing from national parks, forests, and wilderness areas. In a 2015 survey of visitors, the National Park Service found that 1% of visitors are Native American. That's compared to almost 80% who were white. The USDA did their own survey looking at visitors over a four-year period to the U.S. Forest Service and wilderness areas. It said that 2% of the visitors were Native. About 95% were white, a far bigger percentage than the country's general population. Park officials are working on ways to turn around the disproportionate underrepresentation of people of color. So are some Native American outdoor enthusiasts. We were able to connect with Joe Whittle. He's a field patrol ranger with the U.S. Forest Service in Hell's Canyon National Recreation Area in Oregon. Joe is Delaware and Caddo. He couldn't be on our show today because he's dealing with a flood of visitors to his park because of the solar eclipse. But earlier, he talked with associate producer Andy Murphy about a project he's working on to develop wilderness immersion outreach program for Native youth who lack access to outdoor recreation. The program will focus on cultural exchanges between participants and host tribes. He explains why a program like this is needed.
For me, that's really become increasingly more apparent that the economic hurdles for off-res Natives and Natives who live away from a lot of outdoor access are huge. And I know that goes across the board with other minority groups as well. So I think that in this day and age, unfortunately, outdoor recreation is mostly a white thing. It's mostly something that white people have access to, and you don't see as much minority activity in the outdoors, and I think that's primarily why.
Joe mentions that it's important for Native people to be on the other side as well, as park rangers or as guides.
I try and bring the Nez Perce history here alive for people, and so I'll point out things like biscuit root flowers in the ground. You know, the Nez Perce, they planted back these roots for 10,000 years. These are actually what you're seeing as wildflowers dispersed across the land as just quote-unquote nature. It's actually 10,000 years of human history, and I think that it helped people to understand the human history that is a part of this land and to kind of have a different, a more whole perspective on the history of wildlands in America. Personally, sometimes I feel strange about that I am not Nez Perce and that I'm the only one out there who's bringing that story to people. And I really feel like my role would be better served by a Nez Perce tribal member because this is their homeland. So I try to remain conscious of that. I try to be respectful of that and not speak for anyone or not overstep my bounds.
That was Joe Whittle, field patrol ranger with the U.S. Forest Service in Oregon. We're going to meet with some more Native folks who think enjoying the outdoors is important. But we also want to hear from you. Do you agree that outdoor recreation is out of reach for people in your Native community? Or are you an avid camper, hiker, or climber? Join the conversation by calling 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. And just a note, I mentioned the eclipse. For here in Albuquerque, the eclipse has already started. But we want to be respectful to you and your culture by telling you right now that there's a chance we may talk about the eclipse later in the hour. Again, if you want to get in on our conversation about getting outdoors and recreation, give us a call. Phone lines are open. The number is 1-800-996-2848. Joining us now from Denver, Colorado is Dr. Len Nesifer. He's the founder of Native Outdoors, and he is Diné. Welcome, Len.
Hi, Monica.
It's great to have you. So we introduced some statistics in the intro. What do you see when it comes to people of color visiting outdoor recreation? What is your perspective?
I think, you know, if we look back at the history of public lands in this country, especially Yellowstone Glacier, the history is not great for Native people in particular. These were sort of the templates of Indian removal. John Muir, for example, was not a very, very big fan of the Native people that lived in these areas and often talked about them in pretty disparaging terms. And so many of these parks were created by removing Native people from their homelands and creating this sort of ethos of the wilderness that, you know, it's untouched land and it's basically land that, you know, has not seen human contact, which we know is absolutely false. But when we look at, you know, how this translates into the future, the ways in which this was enforced over the past century and the creation of subsequent national parks, it's effectively removed many Native people from the connections that we have to the land in these places. And, you know, I know, especially in places like my part of the world, Navajo Nation, you know, talking about bear's ears can be a sensitive issue because the park rangers were often the ones that would come in and arrest people, cite people for participating in ceremony or collecting herbs or grazing sheep. And so I think given this context and this history, we're at a point now where hopefully things are changing. There's more than ever, there's more Native people of color participating in outdoor recreation. However, the industry itself, the outdoor rec industry, is predominantly white. And you see that in the advertising and the way in which products are marketed and the way in which experiences are described, it doesn't really resonate with the experience that many Native people have in their own lands. And so, you know, it's also a really, I look at this as also an economic opportunity. The outdoor industry, entire industry itself represents about $900 billion in economic activity. And this is from a report from the Outdoor Industry Association this year. And just for perspective, what that means, $900 billion is more economic activity than the auto industry and the pharmaceutical industry combined. And, you know, I always wonder, where's the Native representation in this? Why aren't we as Native people looking at this as a way of potentially developing culturally appropriate and sustainable economic development in our land? I'm currently working on some research to see what the potential would be on Native lands, but just for a reference, there's 90% of national parks are within 100 miles of the reservation. And, you know, that's significant because when we think about how do we create economic opportunities within tribal lands that allows people to stay at home, make a wage, living wage that they can, reinvest into the local economy, this is a really viable way. And the other element is that this is also potentially really positive way for us to reconnect with our land and manage our land in the way that we have done for thousands of years. So just given this sort of, it's not all economic. For me, growing up, my first experiences in the outdoors was collecting herbs with my grandfather, who was a medicine man, and herding sheep. And so the stuff like rock climbing, hiking, we did that more to, like, kill the time while we were living in the sheep graze than relating to it as a separate sport. And so as I went to college and I went off, I felt really disconnected from outdoor recreation. You know, I thought, climbing, it's really technical, it's really hard, you know, I don't know where to start. There was all of these barriers and just, I just didn't feel like I had a place. And so And you know, I think it started small.
Yeah. Let me ask you that, because I'm interested in that entry into that. You know, if you have this long history of, as we all do, of maybe having national park land stolen and then turned into a national park, and so it creates this sort of negative feelings about these parks, and then on top of that, this billion-dollar industry that doesn't appear to be too inviting to Native people. You know, where do Natives fit into that conversation? Where do they fit when it comes to outdoor recreation? And I want to give that out there to our listeners. If you are an avid hiker or climber, or, you know, you just love going camping and you are trying to visit as many national parks as you can on your list, give us a call. We want to hear from you. The number is 1-800-996-2848. How did you get into it? And we also want to hear from folks who maybe don't feel that they are that welcomed into outdoor recreation. Call us and tell us why. Again, the number is 1-800-996-2848. So, Len, you didn't feel that connected to it. You know, the idea of like throwing on a pair of hiking shoes and deliberately going out just to hike and not included with like another family activity or something like that. How did you end up getting connected?
I think part of it was just I started small. You know, I started running, and when I was in college, and I started getting tired of running on the streets. And I said, hey, I'm going to find a trail where I can go run. And, you know, there was, fortunately, I mean, this is also one of the barriers is transportation. I was lucky enough to live within about a couple miles of a river trail in Lawrence, Kansas. And so I started small, and, you know, and I think it was just more of a means to reconnect with nature, because I was tired of running around on asphalt. And, you know, slowly I would start venturing out more and start doing more and more hikes. And it always started small. You know, I mean, I remember the first hike I went on with my parents was when it was a 2-mile loop in New Mexico. And I vividly remember that, because I saw that as just sort of like, this is the entry point. This is the place where it's like, oh, this could be really fun. And, you know, I think the other element is that in high school, the high school I went to happened to have a wilderness program. And so I got exposed to that through the initial trip that we did, and just kind of got a taste of what it would be to go backpacking and do that sort of thing. But yeah, I mean, I think one of the challenges that Joe mentioned is the access to transportation, for example, and the access to gear. I mean, outdoor gear is not cheap, and transportation is difficult if you have family members that are working, or you might not have a car. But, you know, getting outdoors isn't just going out and hiking. It can be things like going to a park or just simply being outside and relating it to it that way. So if you have a garden, I mean, those are valid ways of being outside as well. And, you know, a lot of I'm sort of a person that likes to learn things and learn to teach myself how to do things. And, you know, with a lot of the recreation activities that I participate in now, a lot of it has just been, you know, trying it, giving it a try, and just trying to define it for myself. And if when in those instances where I don't know how to do it, I'll seek out help to fill those gaps in knowledge. And especially with the outdoors, you know, there's a number of Native organizations that are already doing these fantastic opportunities to provide young children with opportunities to be outside. There's, for example, Adventures for Hopi. It's based on the Hopi Reds. There's a man named Marshall Masieva that runs it. But it's a service learning opportunity where students can volunteer doing some trail work, and at the end of the year, they get to go on some really fun excursions. And this is things like kayaking and like POW mixed with a canyoneering experience. There's another on Navajo called the Tour de Res, and this is it's an opportunity in which students from the Navajo Nation can go. They'll get a bike and they'll be able to go on a pretty long bike ride across the res. And I think These sorts of opportunities are really, really important to getting those experiences with the Native communities. And there's people on the ground doing some really amazing work out there. So, you know, I think the idea that, you know, it's completely out of reach, I mean, it really depends on your community and where you're at. And, you know, there's a lot of community organizations that, through Natives Outdoors, I'm trying to highlight and bring attention to not only within the Native community, but also within the outdoor rec industry as a whole. Because, you know, a lot of times these outdoor retailers, they're promoting recreation on what has traditionally been historic lands, and traditionally historic Native lands. And I think they have a responsibility of giving back to our communities because we've been stewards of this land and have basically facilitated for them to be able to recreate on these places.
Hmm. We're talking about heading outdoors today. Are you headed outside or have you already been outside to view the eclipse? Call us and share your experience. The number is 1-800-996-2848. I'm also interested in hearing some of your favorite hiking trails. Where do you like to hike? Where do you like to go with your family, maybe to camp? Call us and tell us about it. The number is 1-800-996-2848. Len, when I first started hiking, I mean, when I was a kid, there was plenty of places to go outside and wander around and things like that. But I remember moving here to New Mexico, and there's a lot of hiking opportunities here. And my sister took me out, and we went around and hiked. And I had a lot of fears about hiking, that I was going to get lost, that I might run into a bear, you know, a lot of things that my sister just basically said, no, we're not listening to that. We're going to go hike. Do you have any suggestions for folks who might be, you know, sort of intimidated by the entire idea of today we go out and hike and we put on fancy shoes and things like that?
Right. And, you know, I think you can have whatever shoes you want to on, whatever clothes you want to on, within reason, of course. You know, I think I always look at hiking as an exercise in, you know, preparing and thinking through things and sort of being prepared. The hike isn't just going out and driving to the trailhead. There's a whole process involved prior to that of knowing where you're hiking, knowing emergency contacts. Will you have cell service out there? You know, what's the proper amount of clothing? These sorts of, you know, there's a lot of preparation that goes involved. And I think that's something that I had to learn the hard way in some instances.
Not having enough water,
yeah. Or starting a mountain hike in the afternoon and getting caught in a thunderstorm.
Yeah. I've done both of those.
yeah. And I think the thing is that, you know, there are plenty of resources online to do this. But I think the other thing is that we, as Native folks who do go out and do this, we have an obligation to do this education as part of our recreation. It's not just us going out and recreating, but it's also providing the knowledge and service to others in our community that might not know. And, you know, and I think the thing is that at a certain point, it does, the fear does lessen and it does become a lot of fun. But a lot of the sort of initial fear can be sort of mitigated if you plan ahead. And, you know, just to kind of generally talk about, you know, when you're doing a hike, you know, my rule of thumb is I always like to go early in the morning, right around sunrise. I always know the route. I have either a printed copy or screenshots on my phone. I tell someone where I'm going. If I'm going alone, I go with others. And then taking the proper amount of water. I mean, one of the things is, you know, it's never a bad idea to take too much. Because that can be good. Taking sunscreen, for example, you know, especially at higher altitudes, the sun's pretty intense and it'll burn you pretty quickly. And sunscreen doesn't, you have to reapply every few hours. And it's just a good rule of thumb. The other thing with, you know, bears are definitely a concern. A lot of places where I've been, I mean, it depends on where you're at. You know, if you're in the Southwest with where we have black bears, you know, it's just important to be aware that, you know, this is their home and you're basically a visitor there. And you know, if you see one, make a lot and loud noise, make your presence known, and back away slowly and don't run away. You know what I mean? And
all good advice. And yeah. Len, hang on. We've got a caller on the line and I want to go to them. Also, if you're just joining us, we're talking about outdoors, going outdoors. Maybe you slipped outside to go check out the eclipse, or maybe you're an avid hiker, camper, rock climber. I want to hear from the rock climbers listening in today. Give us a call. Phone lines are open. The number is 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. Let's go to James in Farmington, New Mexico, tuned in on KSUT. Hey there, James. Where do you like to hike?
Hey, I like to hike in all this region out in this part of the country. You got Cortez, you got Durango, you got Aztec, Farmington, you got Gallup Trail System. You have a nice little trail in Wind Rock. Just recently, I heard they put in a trail in Shonto, which they're having mountain bike trails there now.
And, James, do you like to mountain bike as well?
Mountain bike, road bike, just about everything. And I think what really got me going was when my grandma died from diabetes. So I wanted to kind of take that the extra mile and start getting myself in shape so I don't face that hopefully one day. Yeah, I fell in love with the sport, and from there on, it got serious. As they say, it got real. The struggle is real.
James, thanks so much for giving us a call from Farmington, New Mexico, tuned in on KSUT. And if you've got a favorite hiking trail, we definitely want to hear from you. Here in Albuquerque, I really like the 10K trail, which is on the other side of Sandia near the crest. It's one of my favorite trails to hike on. What are yours? Do you have a good trail on your reservation? We want to hear from you again. The number is 1-800-996-2848. Len, we're about to go to the break, but I just wanted to get maybe your top three trails you like to hike on.
I've been here in Colorado, so I've been a big fan of some of the bigger peaks. One is Long's Peak, which I went up a few years ago. It's a pretty, 6,000 feet elevation gain, 15 miles. It's a pretty long day. You start at 3 a.m., but that was great. Really scenic views. And I think one of the other ones that I really enjoyed is Blanca Peak down in southern Colorado, which is Cisnogeny for us Navajos, which is a sacred mountain. There's plenty of really scenic places there. And I think in the southwest, just being down in Canyon de Chelly, where I'm from here in Salem, Arizona, that was where I got to spend a lot of time.
Right. Hang on one second, Len. We'll talk more about that. We're about to go to a break. If you want to get in on the conversation, the number is 1-800-996-2848. We'll be right back after this short break. Discussions about racism, historical monuments, and free speech are continuing more than a week after the clash in Charlottesville. President Donald Trump gave new life to the debate after he insisted both sides of violent clashes in the city bear responsibility. But where does Native America fit in this conversation? We'll explore more on the next Native America Calling.
Oh, Support by nonprofit community lender Acción, providing small business loans to help strengthen local economies of New Mexico, Arizona, Colorado, Nevada, and Texas. Acción works with entrepreneurs growing or just getting started with an easy application process and personalized one-on-one support. 9% interest loans available through the end of August. More at us.accion.org or by calling 800-508-7624. And by Intertribal H2O, offering Enagic water filters from Japan, which alkalize water in homes and offices. Information about their products and testimonials available at intertribalh2o.com.
Welcome back. You are listening to Native America Calling. I'm Monica Brain, sitting in for Tara Gatewood. We're taking a look at the great outdoors. Have you ever been to the Lapaway Nature Park in Idaho? Have you hiked the 1.5-mile trail around the Frog Bay Tribal National Park in Wisconsin? Have you stayed at the Eagle Lake Campground on the Mescalero Apache Reservation in New Mexico? These are just a few beautiful recreational outdoor areas that are on tribal lands. They provide a connection to nature for all visitors and sometimes add to the tribe's economy. If you're a frequent visitor to your local tribal recreational park or area, tell us about what you love about it. What are the benefits of spending leisure time in the outdoors, whether it's on tribal land or outside of tribal lands? Or if you rarely visit, and you're welcome to join into the conversation as well. We want to hear what prevents you from going outside and enjoying the great outdoors. The number to call is 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. Dr. Len Nessefer is with us. He's the founder of Native Outdoors. And Len, before the break, you were just wrapping up some of your favorite places to hike. Go ahead and finish for us.
Yeah. You know, I think one of the great opportunities that I've had was to travel to British Columbia, to some Native territories up there. And, you know, the area around Banff and it's phenomenal, and I'm a little jealous that I'm not a Native from there, but you know, I think that was a really scenic and beautiful and amazing place, and I hope to go back sometime soon.
That's great. That's absolutely great. And of course, you can get in on the conversation. Are you outdoors looking at the solar eclipse, hopefully with some safety glasses? I'll admit I just ran outside during the break to take a peek, and it looks pretty cool. Of course, we are going to talk a little bit more about the solar eclipse today. Just want to give folks a heads up about that. Let's go to a call. We've got Stephen in Vancouver Island, Canada, tuned in online. Stephen, what would you like to share?
Hey, I'm just wanting to share about the hiking trails here on Vancouver Island. It's pretty cool here. Vancouver Island's 290 miles in length and then 62 miles wide. And there's a development that's happening right now called the Vancouver Island Spine Trail. And it's going from the north end of the island to the south end of the island. And that's going to be done very soon. There's like so many amazing trails here in BC and Vancouver Island. So I just love exploring everywhere.
And Stephen, I understand you also snowboard?
I do, yes. So I have been a part of the First Nation snowboard team since 2009. And that started in Vancouver, BC. And it's reached its way from across Canada and down into Washington now.
Stephen, when you first started snowboarding, I'm just curious, did anybody in your community say, you know, something about like how it's not really a Native sport or there's not a lot of Native snowboarding? I mean, when I think of, you know, the stereotypical snowboarder, I don't really think of someone who's Native.
It was totally something that came up quite a bit is that's why the First Nations snowboard team came into production because it's an expensive sport to get into.
Yeah.
So it started with four people in North Vancouver, and now it's across the nation. So it's pretty cool because we have a recreational program, and then we have a high performance program. So if we're just getting kids into just to get snowboarding, then they go in the rec, and then high performance, they go into competitions across BC or wherever. It's always been pretty interesting because snowboarding has been a huge part of my life, and growing up, it was difficult to afford. So being a part of the high performance team and training to be in the Olympics back in 2010, it was really cool to be able to push myself to that level.
Oh, that's awesome, Stephen. We'll get the name of that snowboarding team and more information about that and put it up on our website, nativeamericacalling.com. And let's take another call. We've got Everett in Ganado, Arizona, tuned in on KUYI. Hey there, Everett. Where do you like to hike?
Well, my favorite one is Canyon de Chelly.
And why do you like it?
Well, that's the first time I hiked down there back in 84, 85, like the way I was saying. And that's the most place that I know on the reservation, but I kind of don't really know about some other hiking trails and stuff like that. I just hear about several other hiking trails, but I haven't tried those others yet.
Awesome. Everett, thanks so much for giving us a call from Ganado, tuned in on KUYI. And I'd like to add a few more voices to the conversation. Joining us now from Tucson, Arizona, is Ashley Thompson. She is a PhD student in archaeology. She's an outdoor enthusiast, distance runner, hiker, snowboarder, and she's also a rock climber, and she's Red Lake Ojibwe. Welcome to Native America Calling, Ashley.
Anine Buju, hello.
Hi. So I just, you know, want to give you an opportunity to tell us about some of your favorite places to go outdoors.
Sure. Climbing has been a huge part of my life this last year and a half. And so since I'm based out of Tucson, my home climbing spot is Babad Doag, which is autumn for the Mount Lemmon, which is just right outside of Tucson. So it's a great mountain for hiking, but also for climbing. There's over 1,000 climbing routes up there, and I find myself on the mountain at least once a week, either climbing or hiking. I also grew up a little bit in Salt Lake City, Utah, and one of the first hikes I ever did as a teenager was the Living Room hike. That's a great one because it's really accessible. The trailhead is just and East Salt Lake right next to the University of Utah, and it has spectacular views of the Wasatch Front of the Rocky Mountains and also the Salt Lake Valley. And then I also would recommend, I work in Montana on Pikani Sakoi, which is Blackfeet country. So this past month I did a ton of hiking in their traditional lands, today known as Glacier National Park. So those are some of my favorite spots for hiking and climbing.
And you mentioned that you like to climb. Tell us a little bit more about that. In particular, I'm interested to know, like, how do you decide what is an acceptable place to climb? And, you know, I mean, we have lots of really sacred rock formations in Native America. And so how do you sort of make that determination of what's okay to climb and what's not?
Yeah, that's a great question. Well, I started, I haven't been climbing for very long, less than 2 years, and it was always a sport that seemed really inaccessible to me. My family, growing up, I was raised by a single grandparent, so we didn't even get outside very much, maybe a hike here or there. And so it wasn't until I moved to Tucson, Arizona for graduate school that I decided I wanted to get into the sport. I'd seen many climbing photographs, and that's what really got me interested in climbing, was these beautiful pictures and beautiful scenic views and people climbing rocks. It looks so beautiful and cool. So I began by going to the climbing gym here in Tucson, and then I eventually met a lot of climbers. I would say at least half of my Tucson friends now are from the climbing community. But yeah, that is a really great question on when is it, what places are acceptable to climb. For example, a lot of climbers and maybe plains tribes know about Bear Butte, or also known as Devil's Tower, in Wyoming. And so what's really cool about this area is that it is sacred to many plains tribes, but it's also a climbing destination for non-native folks. And the tribes in the area have worked out a deal that during, I believe, the month of July, there's a voluntary ban on climbing. So if climbers want to be sensitive to tribal wishes about their sacred mountain, they do not climb at this time. But what I like to do personally is really learn about where I'm climbing. For example, in Tucson, I call it Babad Doag because that's the traditional indigenous name for Mount Lemmon. And so I find out what the tribal folks think of this area. And when I go out climbing, it's just something personal I do, but I put out tobacco just, you know, as thanks and asking for, you know, safety and acknowledging the indigenous peoples of the land. But yeah, I try not to climb anywhere that's been, has restricted access from tribes. And yeah, I always put out tobacco and try to be really respectful.
You know, earlier we were talking about how this $900 billion industry is maybe can be viewed as not that welcoming to Native people. Ashley, have you felt that way? And also, what do you think would make the industry more welcoming for Natives?
Yes, I definitely feel that way. Just the other day, I was in the Salt Lake City International Airport, and I was looking at these beautiful outdoor recreation photographs they had hanging along in the terminal, and I noticed that they were all non-people of color. You know, the majority, I think all of the photographs I saw were actually white people, which can be very unwelcoming to people of color in the outdoor industry. There's some appropriation issues that might make Native peoples feel unwelcomed. For example, in the climbing world, one thing that route setters do is they have the opportunity to name these routes. And so I came across one the other month, and it's called the Trail of Tears. And I was kind of shocked by that name choice because, you know, if we'd called a route, you know, like the Holocaust or something, that would be considered you know, completely offensive. But it seems like when it comes to Native peoples, our history and, you know, our values aren't respected. So I can see why outdoor recreation has a long way to go with Native peoples of it, you know, learning about what's culturally appropriate, respecting access issues. I was on some online forums a few months back, and I was looking up Red Mountain in Scottsdale area. It's a sacred mountain to the Ottawa people there. And some non-Native person was complaining that he couldn't climb this mountain or he couldn't hike it, and he didn't understand why the tribe would restrict access. And so I think it's really important for Native peoples to get in the outdoor scene and maybe to explain to non-Natives that our people have been in Native America since time immemorial, and that these are still part of our culture and part of our traditions, and that certain mountains, especially on tribal land, are restricted because we want them protected and we want them kept sacred and, you know, clean. And I think that just getting more Native peoples outside not only helps our tribal communities by, you know, helping with our physical health, because as one of the callers mentioned, you know, Native people suffer from higher rates of diabetes and heart disease and stuff like that, but also helps with our mental health and helps with our spiritual too. A lot of tribes, you know, certain mountains, certain places are sacred to us, and we gain strength and from visiting them. So being outside not only is good for us individuals, but for like getting the Native perspective out there and letting people know that, you know, these are our original homelands, and we want access to them, and we want them protected in the way we see fit.
Absolutely. If you want to get in on the conversation, there is still time. Give us a call. The number is 1-800-996-2848. Do you have a favorite place you like to climb or hike or camp? We want to hear from you. Again, 1-800-996-2848. Let's add one more voice to the conversation. Joining us from Stanton, North Dakota is Alicia Deegan. She's the Chief of Interpretation and Cultural Resources at the Knife River Indian Villages National Historic Site. And she is Hidatsa and Arikara. Welcome, Alicia.
Hi, thank you.
I understand you're quite busy today. Are you in the path of totality or close to it?
We are not in the path of totality. We're about 84% of the visibility. So any place that is not in the path of totality for the eclipse, they always need to wear their solar glasses. So we have a few hundred people that I'm staring outside my window right now, and they're all looking up, being safe, wearing their solar glasses.
And tell us a little bit about Knife River Indian Village National Historic Site.
So the site here was designated in 1974. It's a National Park Service site, and it is the ancestral home of the Hidatsa. So my ancestors lived here. And there's three village sites that you can see. We had lived in earth lodges, and so there's these circular depressions in the villages here. And the reason people left is because the smallpox had come through and then moved up the Missouri River. And so these sites were then bought by non-Native people and had homesteads. And then Congress decided this would be a really great historic site. And so the National Park Service did that in 1974. And here we are. And it's great to be here and to be able to tell my people's story. And so that's something that we really push for, is to be able to have that Native voice at these sites to tell our own stories.
And what kinds of stories do you share about this particular area?
So there's certain stories that we can talk about all year round, and there's certain stories that you can't mention at certain times. I think a lot of tribal people may have something similar. But one story that we are talking about that we're trying to tie in with the eclipse is the story on the coyote and the sun. And so this story has to do with Coyote, who originally came from the middle of the earth, and he was walking around on the top of the earth and noticed how the sun would travel on his path and the way he dressed. So he decided he wanted to become friends with the sun and dressed like him and walked along the path to go and sit and smoke with him and visit with him. The sun saw this, that somebody had walked up on his path, and did not like that and ended up being mean to him and threw him off the earth and threw him out of the heavens and onto the earth. And so when Coyote awoke from falling out of the sky, he was crawling along, and he had heard dancing and music of the tribe of Wolverine people, of the Wolverines. And so he had went to them and told them what had happened and had said that, you know, this is what happened with the sun. And so he asked them, he wanted to be avenged. And so they went through each of four medicine men in there and this tribe for the Wolverines. And one helped him, and his name was Black Snare, and he had the ability to go to a spider and make a fiber, a snare that you couldn't see. And so they went back up, and they set this all up. And when the sun saw that there's more footprints, he was even more angry than he normally was. And when he got to the top part where he would sit and usually look out, he got caught on that snare. And Coyote then took him down, and they talked about what had happened and what Coyote just wanted to be his friend. And so they ended up becoming great friends. And all this time, Sun is gone. Moon, his brother, comes looking for him. And so he comes and he finds him. And then they create this tradition of coming every time in the fall to go hunting. And so this is one of the stories that we used for the eclipse, and this is one of the stories that would have been told here to also teach children, because you can pull a lot of science from these stories, a lot of tradition. I like to tell our youth that our people were scientists before that word even existed. We just had a different way of teaching.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for sharing that. Let's squeeze in one more call. We've got Chantel in San Diego, California, tuned in online. Hey there, Chantel. What would you like to share?
Hi. Well, my name is Chantel, and I just wanted to say that I am from California. I moved here about 7 years ago, and I actually do hiking a lot. I do hiking, camping almost every week with my dogs. And so there are a lot of areas I've been around in California. And one of the things that I've run into, though, is I'm wanting to explore the native reservations, but I don't really have, well, I've done research, but it's hard to kind of get information on where you can hike and where you can camp. I know there's a general info about, you know, the land that's open to camping and hiking, but there's not really any specifics. And so I think it would be really great if somehow Native communities were able to host maybe a trail or a hiking trail or kind of get the community more involved in these group hikes, just because I don't see that it's readily available, that information. So for me to partner or kind of participate with these other Native communities, it's kind of hard to seeing from the research I've done myself.
Yeah, Chantel, thanks so much for giving us a call from San Diego. And Len, this sounds like something that is right up your alley. What do you think?
Yeah, I just wanted to jump in about some comments earlier that Ashley mentioned about natives in the outdoor industry. You know, my organization really came out of just seeing the single white guy on a mountain ridge and, you know, just not really being able to relate to that. And so my Natives Outdoors, we are primarily a social media organization now where we're sharing a lot of user-submitted content from people all over the world, Native people, and sharing their experience about what it means for them to be outdoors and what they're doing. And, you know, I think that just seeing other Native people doing outdoor recreation, I think also can be a way in which some of the mental barriers to us participating can be addressed within our own community. But more importantly, I think it's a way for us as Native people to engage with the outdoor industry in a way that says, hey, we're also doing this as well. And since we're here, you know, and you're participating in this on our lands, it's important that you respect these places. And so I was just at the largest outdoor retailers conference. It's called Outdoor Retailers in Salt Lake, and I spoke there on a panel about public lands. And, you know, I was probably one of the few Native people there. But just to say, simply say that, you know, brands, companies, all these folks that are out there participating, you have a, you know, they have a responsibility to educate their consumers about you know, respecting Native people and traditions, and, you know, especially around issues around climbing, where is it appropriate, where is not, and then just simply just teach people to be respectful of Native people. I think that's a big thing as well. With regard to what Chantel had mentioned, you know, there's a number of tribes that are actively exploring outdoor rec as a means to bolster the economy and then also you know, provide access to their lands. One example that comes to mind, tying back to Stephen's comment about snowboarding, is, you know, in British Columbia, Vancouver, the ski areas are really accessible and compared to in the Southwest. But Ski Apache is actually a ski resort that's owned by the Mescalero Apache Reservation, and they've operated it since 1963. And so we've had a couple Native people from there that have posted snowboarding video photos and told their stories about what it means. But, you know, I think the other thing is really just starting the conversation within our communities of, like, where is it appropriate for us to hike? Where is it, you know, where is it okay to do these things? And then I think the next question is this something that we want people from the outside or not from the reservation coming and participating in? And if those two can kind of align, then I think there's an opportunity there. But, you know, for a number of communities, that's a challenging question. I know on the Navajo Nation and the Ute Mountain Reservation, there's tribal parks. And so these are parks that, you know, the tribes manage, and they have hiking trails and different sorts of things that are designated as places that are okay to hike in. And I think looking to those as examples that, you know, this has been done before, just maybe not on every reservation or every community, but there are examples of where this is working and this is working well.
All right. And Alicia, we are close to the end of the hour. I wanted to give you a moment. Any final thoughts about getting natives outside, using parks, things like that?
Yeah, I think because all of the United States was all native land, so all of the parks that we have and all the federal lands are at, there is a native story there for people to go to and search out. Like our site, we tell it right there. But some sites, it's a little harder. You might have to dig. But it's that being able to maybe go out, walk through, go and learn the names and the stories of the valleys and the rivers that our people knew for thousands of years. And these sites are here for us to do. And camping and being healthy, and it's all tied in and being connected. I know we do have things that we do on our reservation. It's called the Sanish Survival Camp, a gentleman that takes students out and he teaches them how to do hunting and trapping and camping, making their own tents. And so it's about getting outside and being connected again and learning those traditional ways in a fun way and to create those stewards of the national parks, of our lands, of our tribal history. And so I really think, you know, even if it's just going out and walking, I was thinking about it. My husband and I were in New York City, a very urban area, one of the larger urban populations of Native people, and we were sitting in Central Park on those rocks that are there. And just talking about, you know, who may have sat here and what was their story, like,
right.
Who, you know, what Native tribe was there.
Alicia, thank you so much. I'm so sorry, but unfortunately, we have reached the end of our hour. There's so much more to talk about. Thanks to everybody who tuned in today. Thanks to our guests, Dr. Len Nessefer, Ashley Thompson, and Alicia Deegan. We'll be back tomorrow with another show.
Support by the Northwest Portland Area Indian Health Board.
Were you born from 1945 through 1965? People born during these years have the highest rates of hepatitis C, yet most don't know they are infected. Hepatitis C is the leading cause of liver cancer, but you can do something about it. Talk to your doctor about getting tested. It could save your life. Visit www.cdc.gov/nomorehepatitis.
Hey, yam is to medical cause alite na tu. Look ya olo ikan a yamat that to medicate that a cheap an art that na tu. 1-800-318-2596 and pen an arc and that is medicate.gov in Donawa doa. Look ya Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services Donawa pen an itu lo kenawe. Ela kwa.
Native America Calling is produced in the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation, a Native nonprofit media organization. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting with support from the Public Radio Satellite Service. Music is by Brent Michael Davids. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.